Today, the Columbia Workshop, radio's foremost laboratory of new writing and production techniques, presents a double feature bill, a main play and an afterpiece. First, you will hear A Study in Bells, written by Bogart Carlaw and Howard Connell. This will be followed by a short piece, The House, by André Morois. The workshop's director today is Albert Ward.
Quiet, everybody. Now, look, we gotta whip this thing into shape or we'll never get on the air. You sound effects men all set?
Yeah.
Okay, on.
Everything depends on you.
Sound effects always carries on.
How about you, Professor Fairchild?
Oh, I'm quite ready.
And you, Mrs. Fairchild, do you feel able to continue with the rehearsal?
Yes, I've been ready.
Yes, of course she is. Aren't you, Margaret? A bit of stage fright, perhaps?
Professor, I'm asking her.
Yes, all right. I'm all right. I'm quite all right.
Oh, what a character that guy is. Believe me, if the workshop ever hands me another script like this, I'll... Oh, well. Okay, now, let's run through the whole thing. Remember, you sound effects men, it's strictly your show. If it is a show, and if we ever get on the air. All right, now, let's watch it, everybody. Start on the straight up, and I want to hear those bells. All right? Let's go.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The Columbia Workshop presents A Study in Bells by the world-famous authority on bells, Professor Amory Fairchild. Professor Fairchild.
Yes. Now, Mr. Ward, when we're on the air, I'll begin by saying...
Look, Professor, just read the script, will you? Read the script.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought...
Just read the script. That's the way it's done in radio.
Oh, yes. All right. Now, let's see. Ladies and gentlemen, may I preface my remarks by saying that the Columbia Workshop entertained certain reservations about granting me this time on the air. Their feeling was that the subject of bells was rather recondite, too limited in its appeal. No drama, they said. No punch. Yes, that was the word, punch. I do not wish to abuse the hospitality of the workshop, but I must say that this view is singularly myopic. Actually, bellistics, by which I mean... Can be quite as deadly as ballistics, which you will remember as... On this score, I feel certain that my wife, Margaret Fairchild, assisting me this afternoon, will agree.
Yes, I agree.
Of course, she agrees. She knows, for example, that a bell of sufficient size, rung with sufficient violence in an enclosed area like this studio, would first madden, then stun, then literally kill its listeners.
Oh, please.
But don't be alarmed, my dear radio listeners. On this program, no brutal bell will smash through the frail tenement of your brain. The bells you will hear are merely reproduced. Simulated through the cooperation of the sound effect department, a fascinating branch of this fascinating network. With their help, you will hear the throb, the pulse, the heartbeat of bells, 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 bells. In short, you will hear bells.
Yes, we will hear bells. We will hear bells!
Now, my dear, the origin of bells, like the origin of life itself, remains shrouded in mystery. Who shall say when the first bell was struck? Who knows when the first brazen clangor broke upon the startled air of the fresh, cooled earth? When man rose out of the primordial ooze and stood naked upon the lonely shore, trembling to the universe? Was it already there, pounding in his blood and brain, the rhythm, the terror, the glory of the Paleolithic bell? Well, we do not know for certain. But we do know that millenniums ago, bells were heard in the streets of Egypt. They'd been found among the tombs of the ancient kings. And once in old China, so the legend goes, to forge a bell of celestial character, a beautiful princess was thrown into the seething molten metal. The human heart, the delicate flesh, bone, blood, the viscera, mingled and compounded with the bubbling bronze, was there ever a more exquisite amalgam? It was said that always after that bell carried with it the wail of the dying princess.
Hold it, hold it. Look, maybe we better cut that out about the princess. Gives me the willies. And the radio audience may not like it either. Pick it up from the next page, Professor.
Oh, it's too macabre, eh? It's very well. Well, bells have their cheerful side, too. For example, court jesters always wore bells.
That was a witty one. I say, Your Majesty, did you ever hear the one about the errant knight and the peasant's daughter? Oh, it'll kill you. Well, it seems that one fine day, the errant knight and the peasant's daughter...
Yes, and during the Middle Ages, bells were thought to have a certain therapeutic value. Insurance against the evil eye, the pox, yes, and against the devil himself. The scholars who wrote entirely in Latin took note of these things.
Anathema, maledica dominum, et omnes sancti. Anathema, maledica dominum, et...
All this, of course, is merely digression. So far, we have only brushed the surface of ballistic learning. Isn't that so, my dear Margaret?
Yes. Only the surface. Only the surface!
My wife knows, as perhaps no other person on earth, the full, the true, the unutterable meaning of bells.
I know. I know.
She knows, as I've taught her to know, that all of life is in the bell. Good and evil, the darkness and the light, love and violence and guilt, frustration, lust, the ineffable yearning, the bleak bewilderment, despair, grief, exaltation.
Professor, the script. Stick to the written words.
Oh, yes, yes. I was saying that all of life is in the bell. Now, consider the newborn babe. His mind sensitive, a quiver. And over his crib, the dark man shape of his father and the sound.
Drew.
Pretty bell.
Kitty do. Do.
Later, a few years later, creeping like a snail, unwilling, along the hot, dusty road of learning, he hears... Yes, the good old school bell. And later still, in the flush of young manhood, another bell, significant as the grape, bursting of itself. And the bud uncoiled, and the running sap.
Hello? Oh, yes. Oh, darling, of course. Oh. Hello? Yes. Oh, why, honey, you know I will.
And so, of course, it's wedding day. They sound very pretty, don't they, my dear?
Do they?
Please, dear, you know they do. You sound effects men, would you bring them up again once, please? Bells. The orchestration of life itself. Time, haunted, everlasting. And how shall they be categorized, labeled, attributed? Under mathematics, finance?
That'll be $1.80. Thank you.
Under chronology, the measurement of time.
When you hear the bell, it will be exactly 1 o'clock.
Bells are associated with social amenities, hospitality.
Dinner,
is served.
And sports. Prize fighting. Buffoonery, carnival, sideshow.
Step right up and ring the bell. All right, you with the red hair. Hey, you bar table. Show the little lady she's up with a real bear.
Sure, I tell the little lady I'm loving a real man.
All right, my friend, here you are.
Where?
Now, hit it. Oh, come on, come on. Put some beef into it.
Yes, honey, you show him.
I'll show him. I'll knock that thing right in the...
He did it! He wins the big cigar!
Lady, you sure picked yourself a man.
Bells, bells, bells. The orchestration of life in its infinite variety. Not merely the uttered, but the unutterable. The wordless shadow play of guilt, the tortured compulsion of the crime unfulfilled, writhing in the dark vault of the subconscious, screaming for release.
Whose house is it, the Adamses? No, it's that new family. What's their name? Oh, look. Look at those flames shooting out. Beautiful, beautiful red and yellow flames.
And look there at the window. Look. Oh, beautiful. Oh, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. That was wonderful, wasn't it, Margaret? Wasn't it wonderful? Margaret?
Yes, quite wonderful.
Yes, the door that opens, the gate swinging wide, the exit and the release. It's all there in the sound of the fire bell. It's escape. Escape from the monotony of everyday life. Somebody's in danger from red, yellow, livid flame. Flames are not just livid, but living. Living, not dying. It's an apophysis.
Please.
Professor, look, stop patting your part. You've made your point. It's screwy enough as it is. Now, will you stick to the script, please? Just stick to what's in the script.
Yes, of course, yes, to be sure. Margaret, are you all right?
Yes, I'm all right. But, oh, finish it. Finish it!
I wish that somebody sometime would feel about bells as I do. Well, at any rate, we come now to what many consider to be the most cheerful of all bell sounds. The ringing of sleigh bells on a frosty night. A sort of musical embroidery on the empty canvas of silence. Conjuring up the fir trees and the blue-white snow under the turquoise sky. And the stars glittering and sprinkled across the heavens like granulated diamonds. And somewhere at journey's end, the quiet cottage mantled in tranquility. Now, of course, there is another image that comes to mind, more somber. A family in a troika, racing through the desolate wastes of Siberia, the horses, foam-flecked, frenzied with fear, plunging wildly, and close behind, tongues lolling out, the shaggy, ravening, white-fanged wolves. Now, you have heard how often a child was sacrificed to the wolves. It was thrown out to appease the...
Cut it! That's not in the script. Professor, this is absolutely the last time I am going...
Oh, yes, I know. I stick to the script. I'm so sorry. Bells excite my imagination. Ladies and gentlemen, have you ever heard the crossing bell while you're on a speeding train? Or the bell on the locomotive itself? Was there ever more exalted music?
Ah, oh, golly.
Suddenly make you want to travel, doesn't it, boy?
Golly, it sure does.
It's a lonely sound calling. Make everybody want to travel, I think.
A lonely sound calling to the far places, the lost places, the magic cities of the blind faces. To the painted desert and the green hills and the lure of the great river. And there are the people on the train. The windows are all lighted and you can look in and see them in their seats. The porter waiting to close the door. And that lovely bell on the locomotive keeps ringing, ringing. Why does all your heart and soul move with that train? Why do you feel a tension, as if something were pulling you? A lonely sound calling, uprooting, maddening, turning in the heart. A lonely sound, an open nerve twitching in the void.
Professor, stop letting yourself go. Skip to the next page, please. We got other bells, you know.
Oh, certainly we have other bells. A rich abundance of bells. Crude bells of wood. Seashell bells. Gourd bell, iron bell, bronze bell, silver bell.
All right, so we got bells. We also got a show to finish.
Yes, you remind me of Margaret, my wife. So sensitive. How would you like to carry a bell with you always? To wear it like a noose around your neck? Remember the lepers of the dark ages.
Unclean, unclean, make way for the unclean.
You can kill that one, too. Our audience wouldn't care for that.
Oh, all right. Yes, we'll go on. Did you ever hear the mournful music of a bell buoy? You're standing on the deck, and the wind is cold and wet on your face, and the fog is all around you. And it seems to be inside of you, too. Dark and gray, cold and clammy. And you hear, through this gray darkness, this wet, wet tolling, the dankest, dismalest bell in all the world. The mariner's own funeral bell, I always think. And it has its own delicious beauty. Did you know that the bells of sunken ships continue to ring and ring way down deep under the water? The ship's bells swing to and fro under the sucking currents, tolling the sailor's requiem through all eternity. Seaweed in the hair and the sticky, salt slime and the...
Stop it! Stop it!
But it's all in the bell. It's all there for you to hear, Margaret, in the bell.
I can't stand anymore.
Why, my dear, what's the matter?
Look, is this a private argument, or could I break in?
Pardon us, please. Pardon this interruption. As you can see, my wife is overwrought. She's distrayed. But, Mr. Ward, now you're my witness that I've done nothing to precipitate this outburst. Now, Margaret, please. I thought that you, of all people, would understand. You must know.
I know. Oh, how I know. You and your bells. From the very first day we were married and you took me to that horrible house of yours. Everywhere bells, bells. You held me in your arms. You even called me my little bell. My little jingling bell.
Margaret, please, please, these things are personal. Now, may I go on?
Go on. Go on. In pity's name, get it over with.
Check. Get it over. And the quicker the better.
Thank you. Nobody understands. Nobody. And yet how is that possible? How is... Well, you, Margaret, and you up there in the control room, all of you, I know. I know that bells speak to you just as they do to me. In the dark of the night. In the depths of your soul. Yes, and in your heart. And what do you think the human heart is, after all? It's a bell. Really, a bell. A poor, weak, muffled bell? Only if you'll sit still sometimes and listen, its poor beat will become stronger, and you will hear it filling yourself, filling the world, ringing out at last, proud and clear and true. You do hear it, don't you?
No, I hear nothing.
But listen. Of course you hear it. And you know what happens when you die. that bell is shattered.
You're mad.
Margaret, darling.
You're mad. You're like that horrible hunchback.
Quasimodo. Yes, Quasimodo, high on the towers of Notre Dame. He knew the mystery of the bells. Ah, Quasimodo, to feel the great tides of sound beating upon the heart, the brain, to swing upon the ropes. Released, shot through with the tremendous music. You knew, as I know, the roaring, the surging, the triumphant exaltation of the bells, bells.
Cut it, you guys. Bells. Cut. Can't you see the dame has fainted? Pick her up, somebody. Put her on the chair. Our Volvus. Just a minute, you people. I got to make a phone call.
Hello! Hello. Is this the program writing division? Landry, this is Albert Ward. Look, I'm going nuts. This script you gave me to produce for the Columbia Workshop, it's screwy, I tell you, screwy. You just can't put a study in bells on the air, that's all. Who wrote it? Two fugitives from a lost weekend. Bogart Carlo and Howard Connell. I'm sure that's not their real names. Yes, and this Professor Amory Fairchild. He's a madman, a maniac. Look, please do me a favor. You've got to do it. One little favor. Put me back on school of the air. Please put me back on school of the air.
The Columbia Workshop presents part two of a double feature bill, The House by André Maurois.
Ago, when I was so ill, I kept having the same dream. I dreamed the same dream every night. I would walk aimlessly in the country, and from far off, I would see a long, low, white house framed in a clump of birch trees. To the left of the trees, I could see a meadow bordered with pines. It was all very clear. I was attracted by that house, and I walked over to it. The entrance was barred by a white gate, but once past it, there was a gracefully curving path lined with spring flowers, daffodils, tulips, and daisies, which somehow faded when I picked them. Coming out from the path, I found myself at the house, with a short stretch of lawn running in front. The house was made of white stone, and it had a slate roof. It was a pretty house. The door of light oak with carved panels was at the top of a small flight of steps. I wanted very much to enter the house, but when I rang, no one answered. I was deeply disappointed. I rang, I called out, and in the end, I woke up. That was my dream. Month after month, the dream recurred with such constant precision that finally I came to believe that once I must have known such a park and house. I was certain of it, yet every time I woke up, I could recall no such memory. The mental search for it became so great an obsession with me that I became determined to look for it. Well, the next summer I took my car and decided to spend my holiday driving the countryside in search of the house of my dreams. There's no use describing the trip. I explored all of New England. Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, all, and to my expectations found nothing. At my return to New York in September, I was convinced that no such place existed beyond my dreams. And yet, throughout the entire winter, I dreamed each night of the White House. It was incredible. Last spring, I was so obsessed that I again started on a journey. This time, I tried farther south. One day, as I was proceeding through a valley in Maryland, I felt a sudden shock. It was that curiously delightful sensation that you feel on recognizing, after a long absence, people or places that you are fond of. Although I'd never been in Maryland, the country stretching away to my left was strangely familiar. Tall rows of birch trees sprang up within a clump of pines, and through the first thin foliage, a house was visible. It was a white house. The sensation which followed is difficult to explain. I was sure that I'd found my dream house. I drove on, aware that I should come to a narrow track joining the road 100 yards farther on. I came to it. I rode on to the white gate. As quickly as I could, I jumped from the car and ran past the gate. There was the graceful path I'd so often followed, and there were the lovely spring flowers, the daffodils, the tulips, and the daisies. I picked one or two, and they faded in my hands. Then I came to the bare green lawn and the little flight of steps leading to the light oak door. Eagerly, I ran up the steps and rang the bell. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't really expect anyone to be home.
Come in, please.
I'm going to ask rather a strange favor, I guess.
Do come in, madam.
Thank you. You see, I don't know the owners of this house, and, well, it's all very awkward, but I should be extremely grateful if they could allow me to go over it.
By all means, madam. The house is to let. I am here to show people over it.
To let? How lucky. But I can't see why the owners would leave such a charming spot.
They hated to leave, but they were obliged to when they found the house haunted.
Haunted?
Yes, madam.
But that seems so strange to me.
It should not seem strange to you, madam. You are the ghost.
You have just heard a Columbia Workshop double-header broadcast consisting of a study in bells and the house. In the first offering, the following persons appeared. Eric Dressler was the professor, Virginia Smith his wife, and Bob Dryden the radio director. The musical score was composed by Norman Lockwood and conducted by Frederick Steiner. In the André Maurois short short, The House, the woman was played by Carol Goodner. Both pieces were directed by Albert Ward. Next week, the Columbia Workshop will present Eric Knight's story, Sam Small's Better Half, as adapted for radio by Jack Benveniste and directed by Richard Sandville. Your announcer is Sandy Becker for CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.